Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio. It is day five, day three out on the trail for the mushers, and many of them have started taking their mandatory 24s, as we talked about yesterday. And on the line, calling in from Southern California, is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great. The race is really starting to heat up. Lots and lots of exciting things to happen, and this is the time during the race when a lot of us fans just start obsessing and staying up all night and watching the tracker nonstop and really trying to figure out what exactly is going on in the minds of the mushers and with all the various teams. So there's a lot of really amazing, cool stuff going on.
Speaking of trying to figure out what's going on in the minds of teams, I was reading several articles and I was thinking the same thing myself, is what in the world is Dallas doing? It's not typical for him to run like this, and he's really, really changed up his strategy, it appears, this early in the race, and doing things that's a little bit unconventional for him, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Dallas traditionally will hang back in the first half of the race, will start really pouring it on and pouring on the speed around two-thirds of the way in, and then always finishes very, very strong. So to see Dallas be so dominant and go out in front this early is really very surprising and is not at all the typical Dallas CV move.
I believe he calls it unleashing the monster. I've heard that over the last couple of years. Have you heard that as well?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just calling it that is a little bit intimidating for other teams because they suddenly realize that they have to contend with this almost like the super posse from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, that they look back and here's this team with these dogs that just won't stop, that keep going and going, and you think, who are these guys? And it's Dallas Seavey and his amazing canine athletes.
And I saw a posting today from Martin. He said that he doesn't have anything to prove to anybody. His thoughts are back home with his family, but he's doing what he has to do out on the trail. And, of course, you know, we've talked about it here in the last couple of days with his, I guess it would be his oldest son, is that correct, Nikolai, who was in the wreck early in, in January, and is still recovering and in rehab there in Seattle. Is that right?
Yes, and Martin has referred to Nikolai's journey and his recovery as a different kind of Iditarod, a different kind of race. By all reports, he is doing relatively well. It was a very, very serious accident, but he is in rehab and he is able to walk a little bit and is doing physical therapy. So, you know, it's going to be a long road back for him, but he does seem to be making really good progress.
And if you recall, Alex, when he was giving his updates on his Facebook page about his son and the recovery, especially through the first several days, he was equating it to running in the Iditarod. He was talking about, you know, braving this condition and that, and making a lot of parallels between the two, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've had some interesting developments today. Several folks have taken their 24-hour breaks, and Nikolai, I know Hugh Neff took his there and is now back on the trail. He was in first place for quite a while, and then he took his mandatory break. I guess he had a pretty good issue with some trench foot, probably through that open water that we're going to talk about in a little bit. We had the incident with another knife I find that pretty interesting that it seems like every year now somebody's getting just cut up like nobody's business with a knife, whether it's opening up a sled bag or, you know, trying to cut their fish or whatever they're trying to do. Knives have become pretty precarious out there on that Iditarod Trail.
Yes, and, you know, this, it's interesting that, it happened so early. Fortunately, we were talking about Matt Thaler, who I believe was cutting a zip line, and the knife slipped, I assume, and he cut himself in the knee fairly badly. Luckily, he was at a checkpoint. He was able to get it looked at. He was able to get stitches put in. He decided to take his 24 and see how he was feeling at the end of that. And at the end of his 24, he decided that he was well enough to keep going. So he is back on the trail now. But, you know, I think when Mitch had his accident with the knife, that was quite a bit further up in the on the trail. And you can understand that a little bit more because as the race goes on and people are getting not very much sleep, that they would be more likely to make, you know, to make little mistakes like that that could be, that could have serious consequences. This is pretty early, but from what it sounds like, it was just a normal type of accident that, you know, you might have in your kitchen, I might have in my kitchen, but seems to have been a fairly deep wound requiring that many stitches.
And he said he felt his sock filling up with blood, and he figured, oops, I got to do something here, and ended up having to go to the EMTs or the clinic there at the checkpoint and get it all situated out and fixed. I know just a couple of years ago as well, Jake Berkowitz had a knife accident, and I believe it caused him to withdraw from the race because of it. So, yeah, they're not only are they, of course, knives dangerous, but they're a necessary piece of equipment out there when you're opening up your drop bags and cutting the fish and, you know, making repairs to your sled. Just about everybody will carry a Leatherman or two, and then a lot of folks will carry fixed blade knives attached to their sled so they can cut, you know, dogs away from tangled lines if they get into a fight or have an emergency. And we're going to talk about that here in just a second, because our topic today is sort of one and the same. We're going to talk about losing your dogs and also the open water on the trail. And one musher in particular lost her team, I believe, because of the open water. Is that right, Alex?
Yes, that's my understanding as well. And open water has been a fairly big problem this year. There is not a lot of snow. And some of the river crossings, there's been open water. And as we talked about last night, several of the teams have gotten in, you know, knee-deep or waist-deep to lead their dog teams across, and that's been a fairly serious thing. Now, my understanding is that Kim Franklin lost several dogs on her team, and it's not clear to me from looking at the news reports if they have been found yet. Her sled is not moving, so that just means that her sled is not moving. But this happened to her a few years back when she had two of her dogs on her team got loose and ran back to the previous checkpoint where they were found and were fine. But because she didn't have all of her dogs, she had to withdraw from the race. So I imagine that this situation will be clarified in the next couple of hours. But this afternoon, my understanding is that they had people on snow machines and possibly even a helicopter out looking for these dogs.
Right. And, you know, as you mentioned, this is relatively common. And I know a lot of folks on Facebook were saying, oh, rookie mistakes and this shouldn't have happened. You know, it hasn't happened to me on more than one occasion, but it does happen out there on the trail, especially when dogs get tangled. And this is where the open water part comes into it. When the dogs get tangled, they start to freak out. And the first thing that they do is they begin to chew on their necklines or their gang lines in order to get away from whatever tangle or obstacle that they have. And that's often how these dogs will get away. For people that aren't familiar with mushing, dogs are attached typically at two points on the sled. They're attached to what they call the tug line, which is at the back of the harness, to the gang line itself, the long sections that attach to the sled. And then most mushers will also have a neckline that attaches from their collar to the neck, to the gang line as well. And many dogs, we have, I don't know, maybe five, six, seven of them down in our kennel that are notorious neckline chewers. Typically will carry many replacements out on the trail. Often it happens at the start of the race when you're hooking dogs up. But very rarely do they chew through their tug lines. But again, if their dogs are freaking out or in a precarious situation, they will do whatever they can to get away. So I think that's what happened here with Kim's dogs, and I believe it's what happened just a couple of years ago to a dog on Newton Marshall's team. And that dog ran
right
for well over 100 miles in the other direction to find a checkpoint or whatever to find a place where it had been. So typically dogs will run backwards instead of forwards because that's the place that they just left. And especially if a dog has not been on the trail before, they're very familiar with where they have been, but of course they don't know where they're going. But that dog also happened to be one of Jim Lanier's dogs, who I guess from what you're saying before we aired, he lost his team as well, or some dogs today too?
Yeah. And you know, before we get to Jim, I just wanted to mention too that this is, we've talked a lot in the past about people who have leased dog teams, people who will essentially hire someone else's dogs that they've raised and don't necessarily have a very close relationship with these dogs or haven't known the dogs from birth the way a lot of people who have their own kennels will breed their dogs and will know the dogs from the very first day that they're born. So if a dog gets free and is loose, if you have that kind of relationship with the dog, if this is a dog who has known you for a long time and is putting all of his trust in you, that dog is more likely to come back to you when you call them. If it's a dog you don't have that close a relationship, then the dog might be more likely to panic, to not quite understand what's going on, to want to go back to something that's more familiar rather than, going to you and being attached to the sled. So that's,
right.
I think that's also a very big thing that can happen. And Jim Lanier, today, his sled tipped near the end of the Dalzell Gorge. And he said it was right when you cross one of the ice bridges. And sled tipped over, his dogs ran out into the river, and they were on very thin ice surrounded by flowing water. And he called his team back, and they were able to sort of tiptoe back on the ice toward him. But his sled was still out there on the ice. And so Jim said that there were two dog teams that came by and they both stopped one of the teams. And he said he wasn't sure which teams they were, but one of the teams held the dog team and kept them from running off, while the other musher helped Jim get the sled back off the ice so that he could continue. So this is the sort of thing that is happening just because there's a lot more open water. There is a lot of the ice is not nearly as solid as it has been in previous years.
So he lost some of his dogs. Did they find those dogs? Was it the whole team? I didn't see this story, so I'm unfamiliar.
Yeah, it was the whole team, but it wasn't so much that they were lost as that they became detached from the sled.
Okay.
And they were in close proximity, but because they weren't attached, they could have run off. But he was
right.
able to recapture them fairly quickly.
And just to recap one of the rules here, typically no outside assistance is allowed with the exception of a loose dog team. This is, I believe, is the only time that a musher is able to hitch a ride on a snow machine or a passerby. They're allowed to do that in case they need to run down a dog team. They can always have assistance from other mushers, and that is very common out there on the trail. Many times mushers will help each other out. We talked a lot last year about how Jason Mackey was helping Lance care for his team when his fingers were so frostbitten he could hardly move them because of his previous injuries and the cancer that he's had. So it's very common for those guys to help each other out, but it's rather uncommon that they need to flag down and use the outside resources of a snow machine or something of the such. As a musher, one of the most frightening things in mushing is losing your dog team. Whether you're out on a training run 15 miles from home or in a race situation, you just feel absolutely without anything that you're able to do. It's just one of those things where you just feel defeated out there when you lose your dog team, whether you can catch them, you know, 5 or 10 minutes later, or it takes days to track them down. Days is a little bit of a exaggeration, but you know what I mean. Because typically, if you're out there on a training run, you're walking home, and you could be 20, 30, 40 miles from home, and that's not something you want to do out there in the middle of nowhere. So, Alex, anything else before we get into our musher profile this evening?
Yeah, a couple quick things. Kant's got scratched this afternoon. His dog team was not doing very well. Some of them were not eating. A few of them had diarrhea, so he was resting and trying to decide whether or not to go forward, and then eventually scratched. There was a report that I saw on Facebook that while his dogs were bedded down at one of the checkpoints, and I guess he was asleep nearby, a musher came in and actually ran over one of his dogs. And there were some minor injuries. The dog will be okay, but I have not heard of a musher running over another dog in a checkpoint. That seems very unusual and very unfortunate as well.
You know, that does, and I know that the dog, yes, he was injured, but he's going to be fine from my understanding. But yeah, that's a pretty uncommon occurrence. In all the checkpoints I've ever been in, that's never been something that's on my mind, that one of my dogs or my team is going to get run over by a musher. But then again, you have no idea how close they're parking to each other. I've said several times on social media so far this year, we have a heck of a lot of mushers out there at the same time, and they're all vying for these very small checkpoint positions that they have. Typically, we'll have 50 or 60 teams out there. Now we have upwards of 85 teams out there trying to get into the same checkpoints. So I imagine it's a bit of a traffic jam out there.
Yeah, especially some of the checkpoints just seem like there are, at some points 25 or 30 teams in the same checkpoint. And typically checkpoints are not really built to handle more than a dozen teams at the same time. So
right.
having a whole lot of people in one place can get a little bit iffy. Before we move on, I just also wanted to mention that we talked yesterday about the Loafer from Ofer Award. It looks like Dallas Seavey is winning pretty much all of the awards so far. He won the Pan Air Spirit of Alaska Award for being the first McGrath last night after we got off the air. Also just won this afternoon the Dorothy Page Award for the first of the halfway point, which is Cripple, where it seems like he will be taking his 24. But he also won this new award for being the first to Ofer. And this award is named after Roger Roberts, the loafer from Ofer, who died last year after the race. He was the only permanent resident of Ofer from the early 70s through the late 80s, was a gold miner, raised dogs and trapped, ran the Iditarod a bunch of times, but was never really competitive. And then after the 80s, he would return every year to the mine in the summers and would be there to open up his place in Ofer for the Iron Dog and the Iditarod race in the winter. A longtime volunteer, musher, checker, trail breaker. And so the award is a trophy and $1,000 in gold nuggets. So that's
very
a
cool.
Nice thing to get for being first into
and
Ofer. And Dallas won that. And, of course, now that he's stopped for a while, I think there's a chance that other people can win some awards this year as
right.
well.
Right. And you know, folks, that they are carrying these awards with them in their sleds, obviously, as they head down the trail. All of these awards, they are presented to them at the checkpoints. This mask, as we talked about, the Spirit of Alaska Award, the Pen Air Spirit of Alaska Award, as well as these gold nuggets. And all of that is presented to them at the checkpoint, and then at the award ceremony at the finisher's banquet, do they get all of the stuff, whether it be the gold nuggets or the cash or whatever. I don't know. If I received that award where they get the $3,500, I don't know if I'd want to carry that around with me on the trail, or I'd have it transferred into my bank. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I would do that too, or at least wait until you got to Nome to take it. I don't know that if you lost $3,500 $1 bills on the trail that would be a good thing.
There you go. All right, for folks that are listening live, if we do run over, remember you can listen to the episode in its entirety over on mushingradio.com after we air. Unfortunately, the way that our streaming system works, it does cut off at 30 minutes, so I apologize if we're still talking and that happens. We're going to make sure that we finish our stories tonight. And today we're going to talk about Ryan Olson. What do you have for us, Alex?
So Ryan Olson is a very colorful and really engaging and cool musher. She is someone who uses social media extremely well. If you go on her website, which is Rhino Kennel, rhinokennel.com, there is a daily blog about her, what's happening with her team in the Iditarod with a bunch of pictures and descriptions of her runs and her dogs and really just a lot of information. And she's got a Facebook page, which is very active as well. I'm not sure who's writing the blog for her. It's obviously not her. You're not allowed to post anything on social media while you're in the race. But whoever is doing her social media is doing just a fantastic job. Ryan grew up in Colorado. And, incidentally, I should mention before I get into this too much that there's a great interview that you did with her on Mushing Radio about a year ago. So people should definitely Google that and check that out. She grew up in Colorado, and then on her 13th birthday, as a present, she was given a sled dog ride. And from that day forward, she always had in the back of her mind that it would be really great to be able to be a musher and run sled dog. So after her, I believe, sophomore year in college, she decided to take a break for a little while and got a job as a dog handler in Michigan, ran a bunch of races. And then in 2010, she knew that she wanted to get more serious about it. So she emailed Allie Zirkel from SP Kennels and started working for Alan Moore and Allie Zirkel as a handler. She said that she was their first full-time handler, living on the property and taking care of the dogs and scooping the poop and all of the wonderful handler chores that people do. and learned a tremendous amount about dog care, about their particular dogs, about Alan and Allie's philosophy of raising dogs and racing and what is important to them. And then in 2012, she ran their puppy team in the Iditarod and did very well. We've talked in the past, I don't think we've talked too much about it this year, but we've talked in the past a lot about people running puppy teams and how the goals for running a puppy team, which usually is not literally puppies, it's usually like, you know, two-year-old dogs, the goals for that are a little bit different. You're not necessarily looking to go fast or to, you know, be competitive, but you're looking to get the dogs used to being on a really long race, get them used to the different things that happen in a race, going to places they haven't been before, getting used to the cycle of running and resting and eating and bootying and bedding down in at checkpoints and camping. And really the goal when you're running one of these puppy teams in a race like Iditarod is you want them to just have a really good time. You want them to be able to think of this 1,000-mile race as a really fun thing to do so that the next year they'll want to do it again. And in doing it again, they'll be going now to places they've been before and they'll remember, oh yeah, I was here last year and it was a really fun time and that's where I saw a moose and all of these things. So she ran their puppy team, did very well. And then she decided that after that she wanted to start building her own kennel. She got she bred a couple of dogs from the SP Kennel dogs, got a couple of dogs from some other mushers, and then started building up her own kennel. I believe at this point she has somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 or 30 dogs, and she said that she's still in Two Rivers, which is where SP Kennels is, and said that she's now actually living right next door to where Alan Moore and Allie Zirkle are. So she is still very much in their orbit and literally next door to them. She went back to school in 2012, finished her degree in accountancy, graduated magna cum laude, has a pilot's license, and in addition to mushing and working as an accountant, she likes to go off adventuring in the wilderness in Alaska. And as I mentioned, lots of really great information about her and what's going on in her race at rhinokennel.com. And just a very, very interesting and engaging and compelling musher. And I think this is someone that we are definitely going to see a lot more from in the next few years. She did she's done the Yukon Quest. She finished the Yukon Quest last year and also did very well. And I believe this is her first Iditarod since that 2012 race.
And Alex, I don't know if you know the answer to this one, but did you see the Hawaiian style leis that she and Allie were wearing there at the ceremonial start? Do you know the story behind that at all?
I don't. There were actually quite a few mushers who were wearing leis at the ceremonial start. So I will try to find out exactly what was going on with that, because that's an interesting story.
And I have one other piece of information I thought is kind of interesting. I was looking at the musher profiles on Iditarod.com last night after our show, and I was surprised to see how many of these folks are college graduates. Well over, I don't know, maybe at least a quarter, maybe even a half of them have gone on to college and finished. Several of them have master's degrees, and of course we know of several physicians and nurses that are out there. That's sort of outside of what most people would think. When you think of a musher, you think kind of a you know, of a hardcore wilderness person, you know, the person that can get out there and survive. You wouldn't think that they would be, you know, somebody that spends a lot of time in the classroom, if you know what I mean. What is your comment to that?
Yeah, I noticed that as well, and they were actually talking about that during either the ceremonial start or the restart. I think first of all, some of these cliches and some of these images that we have of people in general and mushers, I guess in specific, are probably things that were more accurate, you know, 30 or 40 years ago than they are now. As we've discussed many times, it is complicated and expensive to be a musher and run the Iditarod. So for most of these people, they are doing a bunch of other things and trying to figure out how to make a living and pay for their very expensive dog habit. So it's not that surprising to me that there are so many people who have degrees and advanced degrees. The other thing I've noticed just in general about people who live in Alaska is most of them do three or four different things, and sometimes the combination of things that they do is very surprising. So you'll have someone who is, you know, a commercial fisherman and an epidemiologist, and you think to yourself, well, those two things don't really mesh together. But in Alaska, there's just a lot of people who have different passions, and they like to pursue all of them.
Right. And you had mentioned there with Ryan, the reason I brought that up is that she went to school to become an accountant, but she's also a pilot. Those two there sort of don't go hand in hand as well. And I find it very interesting, like you said, that so many of these folks have so many driven passions behind them, whether it's you know, their careers outside of mushing or what they've done, you know, growing up or whatever. You always find that interesting part of the story. And in regards to those advanced degrees, we talked a little bit about those leased teams or whatever you want to call them, you know, those bio teams or whatever. Typically, those are the folks that are much more well-to-do, so to speak, you know, the doctors and the lawyers and whatnot, and they have obviously the capital or the expendable income to be able to do that and pursue this dream of running Iditarod.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me until I realized once that there were one year, I think, six or eight doctors and nurses all running Iditarod, and I asked one of them why they thought that was, and they said, well, you know, this is expensive, and you have to have the money to be able to pay for this, and if you're working in the medical profession, you are more likely to have that kind of expendable income.
And not to sound tongue in cheek here, but with all these knife accidents, all these doctors and nurses out on the trail, they should have no problems helping him out if an emergency arises.
Exactly, and you know, interestingly, in a lot of these places, there is no full-time doctor living there, and some of these villages are places where, if they're lucky, there's a doctor who comes through a couple of times a year. So in the past, we've seen where there have been relatively minor injuries to the mushers that sometimes the vets have been able to help out, and I don't know if it was a vet or an actual doctor or nurse who gave Matt Failer his stitches, but it is completely possible and conceivable that, you know, in the past there have been minor injuries that have required like a stitch or two, and the veterinarians have performed that on the mushers.
Tough cookies out there, that's for sure, not only the dogs but the people as well. So, Alex, we are definitely out of time. We are recording as we speak. Who are we going to talk about tomorrow, and do you have any particular subjects you want to mention here as we get into about the halfway point of the race, our day six coverage coming up tomorrow at 6 p.m. Alaska time.
Yeah, tomorrow we're going to talk about Rob Cook, who is a very colorful and interesting musher who runs a team of Siberians. So that should be interesting. And, you know, I think probably we'll talk a little bit about the 24-hour rests and the strategy behind that, which we touched on today but didn't really have a chance to go into. So we'll probably go into that. And, of course, if people have particular topics or questions that they are interested in, they should definitely find us on social media. We are very active on Twitter and on Facebook. I am at Coldfoot Films, and you are at Robert Forto. And, you know, also they can search Dog Works Radio on Facebook. And we are very happy to hear what's on your minds. And if you have any topics that you would like to hear discussed, I think that's we would definitely want to get to those.
That's right. And you can find all of our episodes over on mushingradio.com. We have a graphic of the Iditarod, the same graphic that you see all over the internet on the right side of the webpage. If you just click on that, there will be all of the shows for this year. You can also download our shows on iTunes, so you can listen to them wherever you're at, whether you're on the treadmill at the club or driving into work at rush hour, wherever you can listen to us then. A good friend of mine posted last night that he was listening to us on his headphones as he was doing his dog chores up in Minnesota. So I thought that was pretty interesting. We have people that are listening all over the world, and we'd love to hear where people are from. We do this out of love, I guess. We do it because we like the Iditarod and the stories behind it. Neither one of us are paid to do this, but somehow or another, we keep coming back every year. And I do want to thank my co-host for doing this 3 or 4 years now. The years are running together as we continue to do this, but we do this because every year somebody will say, "Hey, are you guys doing this again next year?" And for whatever reason, we're always back on the air. So I do want to appreciate or thank all of our fans and, of course, my co-host and also the folks over at KVRF 89.5 here in the Valley. They're airing all of our programs every night during Iditarod coverage. Typically, we're only on the air on Wednesdays there, but they're kind enough to put us on the air every night. So I guess people are listening here in the Valley as well. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Dog Works Radio. And, Alex, I think we're out of time. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
Excellent. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.